Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com, or you can go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, and it will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm awesome. Doing good tonight. We got a good show lined up.
This is an auspicious week that's going on here.
Absolutely. We have got, this is the PJ Manny week. This is
PJ Manny week,
and
all week long on Fast Forward Radio.
That's right. And she's just such a great guest every time that we just love having her on as often as we can. So,
well, I guess with having said that, we should just bring her on out, a guest who needs no introduction on Fast Forward Radio. Our official Hollywood correspondent and empathy expert, PJ Manny. PJ, welcome back once again to Fast Forward Radio.
Hello, gentlemen. I'm thrilled to be here as always.
Well, it's always an honor to have you. And we were talking on Facebook earlier about, how many shows constituted PJ Manny Week. And unfortunately, it's really just the two. We did the archives and tonight. But I will mention you during the monologue show on Saturday. It will come up that it's PJ Manny Week. But I was saying on Facebook, and I think, Stephen, I think this is correct. If we ran a different show with PJ on it every night, what would that get us? Oh, at least a week. I'm thinking more like 2 weeks of straight shows. Is that right?
I think we got about a baker's dozen of PJ Manny shows in the can, and that's just awesome.
Well, it's not nearly enough. Let's put it that way. It's not nearly enough.
Yeah.
That's a good start.
Oh. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I'm loving the love.
And, another auspicious thing going on this week I would be remiss if I didn't mention is I think yesterday was Yuri's night. And we always serve that on Fast Forward Radio. I did not have an opportunity to celebrate. I don't suppose either of you had any Yuri's night observations.
Not on this end, no.
I went outside in honor of Yuri's night and looked at and did a little stargazing with the kids actually. Last night, took the iPhone out there and used that app to look at some more of the constellations and things. So we talked about that a little bit. It's also since I took the kids to see a Civil War reenactment on the weekend. I reminded them it's 150 years now since the Civil War started. So it's also this week, I believe. So
wow, this is like this day in history on Fast Forward Radio.
Exactly.
All about the future. Today. Yeah. Well, yeah. But well grounded in history, though. I think that's very important. Well, that's pretty auspicious. Huh? 150 years ago that the Civil War started.
Yeah.
And the war lasted, 4 years, is that right? Ended in...
That's right.
Five? So, goodness.
Yeah, it was a four-year war.
Yeah, so we got the kind of bookmarks there, aren't they, really, when you think about Yuri's Night, this great accomplishment, Civil War, this great tragedy that kind of kicked off, all kind of occurring at the same time. What a wonderful kind of way to lead into talking about our subject this evening.
Absolutely. What we're talking about tonight is empathy. And I thought we mentioned something that was on Facebook earlier today. Alex Lightman, who has been on Fast Forward Radio once or twice. I forget, Phil, if he's been
at least
on board.
Yeah.
Okay. He said, you know the song, What the World Needs Now is Love, Sweet Love? He says, if I was to rewrite that today, I would say what the world needs now is imagination, innovation, creativity, and speculation on the possible. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I responded, and love, sweet love. So, anyway.
you know, and you were so right, Stephen.
let's not forget the love, sweet love, as we think about all these other things. But yeah, absolutely. I think actually this is a speculative topic. I mean, empathy is. It should be. All these other things that we talk about: imagination, innovation, creativity, and speculation, whatever. I think that can grow out of empathy for our fellow men. So, you know.
And what good are they really if you don't have that? I think is the other interesting question. I mean, we have Michael Anisimov on all the time, and others from the Singularity Institute talking about the need for friendly artificial intelligence. And certainly we would want artificial intelligence to have all of those characteristics, imagination and creativity and all those things. But above all, we want the friendly, right? We want the nice. We want the good, the love from those entities. Or the intelligence might be dangerous. It might not even be something we're interested in. So why would we feel any differently about people? What do you think, BJ?
Well, you have to understand that empathy isn't just something that people or potentially AIs have. Empathy is something that many animals have. In fact, most mammals we recognize have empathy. Because it is such a useful and powerful tool for survival and evolution, it makes complete sense that any other kind of created being would need that to relate to other beings in its existence. You know, empathy is one of these things that we for a long time thought only humans were capable of. But in fact, it's really seen in the animal kingdom as the result of nurturing. So you have parental, but more specifically maternal nurturing. The mother has to look at the child and figure out its various states of ease or dis-ease and figure out how to take care of those to provide for the child. The child, on the other hand, has to watch the parents and learn how to behave in the world, has to learn a certain kind of, you know, we would call it a moral structure, but in a sense, animals have a morality themselves. You know, apes and other large mammals like elephants and dolphins have a sense of fairness, of equality and sharing. And these animals aren't born with this. They're actually taught this. And the only way that a young animal is taught this is through emulation. So by watching their parents or other superior adults in their group doing things in ways that work and are considered the right way by that animal group, they learn how to behave. And empathy is a part of that.
Would it be appropriate, before we get any deeper, to quickly define what we mean by empathy for those who might be unclear, because we're talking, you know, sharing, you know, several different concepts came up. At fundamental level, what is it?
Fundamental level, empathy is the ability to imagine yourselves in the shoes or, you know, of paws of another. And I say, you know, hooves and paws because we don't only have empathy within our species. There is also cross-species empathy. And we actually see this in a surprising amount with our domesticated animals like dogs. Dogs are actually bred to have an empathetic response where we can read their signals and they can read ours. And, you know, I'm sure everyone's had the experience of where, you know, you've been sick or your dog or cat's recognized your illness and has tried to comfort you by, you know, curling up against you or something like that. Likewise, we have the same, you know, relationship with, you know, reciprocity with our animals. So this ability to be within the shoes of another is a pretty sophisticated evolutionarily state of mind. And one that you can actually see develop in young humans because, you know, babies are not born with that theory of mind, you know, that sense of self-consciousness and that ability to go, wow, can I imagine myself in that other person's shoes, can I? But they do have that early sense of emulation, which is the same wiring neurologically that empathy works on as well. So using that emulation, they eventually develop that theory of mind, that sense of, you know, I am my own person, I can imagine this mental state of another person and predict how they're going to behave.
So it sounds like it's a fairly sophisticated ability to empathize with others. So you're talking about mammals having it. There must be a cutoff, right? Salamanders don't empathize, right? Or is
we really don't know yet.
Okay.
We honestly don't know. I mean, mammals are the easiest to understand because, A, we can hook them up to an MRI pretty easily,
right,
and we can actually see the neural activity. I mean, that's actually how they discovered this notion, the neurobiology of empathy in the first place. At the University of Parma, they were watching monkeys work with nuts, and they wanted to see where everything lit up in their brains when they were looking at the food and eating the food, et cetera. But what they discovered in one of those wonderful kind of crazy accidents of science, a worker decided to eat the food himself, and the monkey was just watching. The monkey had no access to his food. And they watched the MRI light up like a Christmas tree in exactly the same places that it had when he was eating the food. So his brain was reacting in many ways the same way, watching someone else eat the food, as he was when he was eating the food himself. And
so,
when they tried this,
having this vicarious eating experience, watching the human being eat.
Correct. And
wow.
And so that's where we discovered this whole notion of mirror neurons. That's what the Italians eventually called it. And this idea that there's a neural system that emulates observed behavior by firing the neurons that you would use if you were actually doing that behavior. Now, as someone who's a former dancer, I instantly related to that concept, because one of the things you learn in dancing is this, you know, very deep mind-body connection. And when I watch another dancer dancing, I actually have to stop myself from moving myself. And I know my brain must be going off like a Christmas tree, because I'm imagining what that choreography would feel like in my body.
Right.
Now, that's a very specific case, but in fact, we do this all the time. And that notion of us being able to physically relate just through our brain chemistry, you know, is extraordinary.
You know, it's true. It seems that one of the things we're always doing is just constantly modeling the world around us, right? We're modeling not only what we're actually interacting with, but things that we might potentially be interacting with. We're modeling the things that are happening, the things that we might be about to touch or say, or you know, whatever kind of precipice we're sitting on. There's this constant like model that we're building in our minds, and it actually is having this kind of physiological effect on us. And it sounds like with empathy, we're not just modeling that other being. It's like we're modeling the experience of that other being. We're modeling the identity of that other being to some extent within ourselves.
Exactly right. And the thing, first let me just preface this by saying, you know, these are ideas that have been discussed by a number of far more learned people than I, like Franz de Waal, Jeremy Rifkin, I'm having a total blank, J.D. Trout, the psychologist J.D. Trout. You know, these are ideas that are floating around a lot right now. There's a very popular notion to discuss, but part of it is because we are seeing a scientific biological modeling, as you've just described it, of this behavior. And I just lost my train of thought. Could you repeat your question one more time?
So yeah. So the idea is we're modeling not only behavior, but actually, in some sense, modeling the identity, modeling the actual experience of being that other person.
Right. So I wanted to mention Jeremy Rifkin because one of his big points is that, you know, we're social animals. We're not the only social animals. Many animals are social animals. Therefore, the notion of empathy, that we would be able to relate to our fellow creatures within our tribe, within our pod, within our, you know, whatever your group, your den of wolves, would be a very important trait to have. Now, what happens when we don't have empathy? Well, I don't want to discuss autism because that's actually a very different topic and is often related to in empathy conversations. And I believe that's on a different continuum in terms of empathy or how much empathy one has, because empathy can be taught with people along the autistic spectrum. But we often talk about people who don't have empathy, and they fall into two categories, and those are sociopaths and psychopaths. And those are often delineated, and I don't know how much I'll accept these for these definitions for the purpose of this discussion, but the definitions often are psychopaths are born with no empathy, no ability to empathize, and sociopaths are socialized through some traumatic series of events to cut themselves off from their emotional attachments and therefore have no empathy. So it isn't that they were necessarily born that way, it's that they had fundamental experiences which shaped their neurobiology that way. So we know what happens in society when we have people who are psychopaths and sociopaths. Bad things happen with these people. They act against the general social good. And there are animal examples of these kinds of creatures. And not surprisingly, in the animal kingdom, they don't survive very long.
Right.
You know, with humanity, they survive a little longer. In fact, they can survive surprisingly well. But we as a social group won't tolerate it. So we either imprison them or give them medical treatment or whatever it is.
Well, now, it's interesting to consider that just within the human framework, for example, you talked about the fact that there is a survival advantage on an evolutionary standpoint for empathy.
Yes.
So let's talk a little bit about what that advantage is and why some outliers would end up not having that.
Well, the survival advantage of empathy is that as a group, you can imagine better outcomes for the group in general.
Okay.
So if everyone was only concerned with their own survival, they would be by themselves. The entire brunt of their survival would be on their shoulders. Whereas in a group where you care about the other people in the group's survival, where you can imagine that their ability to survive is as important as yours, you can come together and use all of your skills as a group to survive. Now, we know, especially in prehistory, you know, there is actually a number at which a tribe is no longer viable. It can be too small to survive.
Right.
So you had to keep your tribal numbers up to a certain number, A, for, you know, genetic prosperity, you know, so you weren't having too much inbreeding, but also because, you know, the whole point of animals is survival. You know, we are programmed to reproduce and make more of ourselves and think that's a good thing. So, of course, you're going to want your children to survive, and you're going to want to imagine their mental states, right? And you're going to want them to imagine yours because that will help survival. And you're going to want your in-group to survive because, you know, if one can hunt and one can fish and one can gather, you know, berries and the other are watching the children, et cetera. If you have people with different tasks all working together for your mutual survival, that's good too. The odds of your survival are that much higher. Again, not so far from the animal kingdom. It's, you know, this is exactly what primates do. Franz De Waal talks about this all the time. So you can see why it was selected for. To be
I'm going to take the real devil's advocate argument just for a moment. Okay.
Go for it.
That within the group, yes, but it seems to me that one of the reasons there might be psychopaths and sociopaths that capability still might exist is from an individual standpoint, And I'm not talking about being nice or anything. I'm not talking about being a good person. But just from an individual standpoint, it seems to me there might be survival advantages around not empathizing with others. And
well, there is actually something to be said. I don't know where I read this, but that a surprisingly high percentage of CEOs and politicians are considered on the sociopathic spectrum.
Yep.
And actually quite seriously, because they have an ability to, you know, many sociopaths are very skilled at making you believe they empathize. They, while they're not actually empathizing, they've trained themselves to have the social markers for empathy.
Right.
And if you can believe that they feel your pain, you can believe that they have your best interests at heart.
Right.
And most leaders, believe it or not, are actually more likely to be sociopathic than non-leaders because of that, because they're willing to do whatever it takes to get to the top and then pretend they empathize with you so they can stay there.
Very interesting. So it is actually a skill set that – or skill set, I don't know. It is a set of tendencies that has proved itself advantageous even within a larger context where empathy is true, because we have survived as a group, and it's empathy that's helped to do that.
But when you look at percentages, and certainly in the modern time, sociopaths are selected for in terms of survival, but we're still only talking about 3% of the population for sociopaths and 1% of the population for psychopaths.
Right.
You know, so it's still pretty small compared to the general public.
Right. The example that actually came to mind, and just because to me, everything always has to have a movie counterpart for it to be real for me, but I was thinking about Matt Damon in The Talented Mr. Ripley, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
If you've seen that movie, right? I mean, he gets through life pretty well by the fact that he apparently has no real connection with anyone. You know what I mean? That he's able to turn that off and do whatever he needs to kind of to kind of get to the next step, but it's I think we can all agree not who we want to be.
You know,
I was just gonna say
that we have a lot of fictional heroes that have the markers. You know, I mean, James Bond. He's able to kill the bad guys without remorse. He hops from bed to bed, doesn't worry about establishing any relationships with anyone.
That's a good point.
Sherlock Holmes, House, Dr. House, all these characters, in a lot of ways we admire their ability to turn off, the pesky empathy that bothers the rest of us, I guess.
Well, that's really interesting, because there's a fascinating idea that just recently been blogged about in Scientific American by Andrea Kaczynski. And Andrea, I'm sorry if I mispronounced your name. She wrote a fascinating blog called...
That's always how I pronounce it in my head. Okay, so...
Okay, perfect. Thank you. Well, I'm dyslexic, so you never know what you're going to get. But her blog is called Walking the Line Between Good and Evil, The Common Thread of Heroes and Villains. And what I love about it is she identifies this notion of the sociopathic villain as compared to what she calls the ex-altruist, meaning the extreme altruist, and being the hero type. And being the hero type that you've just described, not really someone you want to spend a lot of time with, but who are heroic in the extreme. And she compares their traits, and she says that, she shows that the sociopath and this ex-altruist or extreme hero are surprisingly similar, except for a few crucial differences. And one of them is the ability to empathize. But as you said, they also have the ex-altruist has this remarkable ability to turn on and off their ability to empathize and feel the other person's pain. Because let's face it, if you're in a really dangerous situation, you have to be clear-headed and relentless.
Right.
So the notion, you know, if you're constantly feeling, you know, you're not going to get a lot accomplished. You're going to be a massive jello in the corner. So with these extreme heroic types and being real live people, not just fictional narratives, you have this ability to turn on and off their empathy. The empathy is always there, but they're able to suppress it. They're able to say, you know, I can't feel it right now because my ultimate goal will be impeded. And they're not doing it consciously. This is a form of behavior that, you know, frankly, knowing a handful of these people in real life, I also recognize that some of it is actually genetic, you know, that I don't think these people learned this behavior. I think they're wired that way.
And who are these extreme altruists? They're, what are they, EMTs, that sort of people? Or, I mean, what
I'm sorry, can you...
I'm just saying, who are these people who are on the extreme ends of altruism? What do they do that indicates that? Are they emergency, you know, like firefighters? Or?
Well, she uses the example of the guy at Fukushima who donned scuba gear and dived into the tsunami to rescue his wife and his mother. You know,
right.
You know, these like really extreme displays of heroism, where you think, holy cow, how did they think they were ever going to be able to pull that one off?
Right.
Or, you know, cultural heroes who are constantly putting themselves on the barricades to accomplish these great acts of social change. Because that's an interesting thing that she talks about is, you know, both sociopaths and these extreme heroes are people who look at the rules and laws of society and say, nah, that doesn't work. Then, you know, the sociopath takes advantage of it. The ex-altruist or extreme hero says, this is a bad law. This is a bad rule. This is a bad societal norm. It has to be changed. And even though what I'm doing may be, quote, unquote, against the law, you know, civil disobedience during the civil rights era or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, it is ultimately for a greater good. And I'm willing to sacrifice myself and often others to accomplish that goal.
Right. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. So now, with that in mind, have we concluded that James Bond is a good guy or a bad guy? Where does that
Well,
mean?
Interestingly, I actually think he's more of an anti-hero, and
okay.
that's a very different kind of thing that we're talking about. You know, I actually don't. I think he's someone who doesn't have much empathy, and he just has a sense of he's a good guy and those are the bad guys, and boy, they gave me a gun and I can kill people. Great, you know. And let's face it, those people exist too.
Yeah,
they're,
I think especially
you know, they're doing for the right, but
version.
They're not sort of the nicest people.
Right. Yeah. I think
well, you know,
particularly
you know,
current iteration is like that. He's very less empathetic even maybe than some of the earlier ones.
Well, it's why Casino Royale will always be the greatest James Bond movie because you actually see it happening to him. You know, I mean, you see basically empathy being pulled from him, or, you know, he just turns it off as he's faced with these situations. And in order to become the James Bond character we see later on down the timeline, but he's It's so early in his career that he's still kind of a normal guy, turning off those feelings. It's an interesting movie for that reason to me.
Well, and yeah. Andrea also discusses that you can go from being an ex-altruist to a sociopath. That there actually is a psychological mechanism of, you know, trauma, and a need to repress all your emotions because they're too devastating for you. That could turn someone who is a hero into a sociopath.
Hmm. So here's a question then: could we work that the other way, find all our sociopaths and somehow help them cross over to the other thing that they're similar to, which is the heroic altruist type? And that kind of brings us to our controversial question from last week. I had read on Facebook. I thought a really intriguing question because it came around the same time that some interesting discussions were going on around this. Question of empathy versus cruelty, and actually seeing the physiological markers for empathy. There was a piece on about that, and Karen Murray had written a piece talking about if there was
a medication that would make people empathetic, or a treatment. I don't think she actually specified what it would be. Who knows, maybe surgery, might be something else. Should it be mandatory? Would we enforce empathy on others? And Stephen and I talked about that a little bit last week, but I'd like to give that hypothetical to you, PJ. What do you think? If there was an empathy pill, should we make people take it?
Okay, this is so complex. First of all, let me make some ground rules. Number one, there are people who don't have empathy who survive very well in our culture, who don't do horrible things.
They're not Ripley, right?
They're not Ripley.
No.
They're James Bond. Right, exactly.
Well, or not even
you
that. They don't hurt anybody necessarily, right? They just don't care.
Yeah.
You know, this would include many people along the autistic spectrum who may have a form of empathy for one, two, or a handful of people in their life, but really, in general, have a hard time putting themselves in the shoes of other people. You know, they're not doing anything wrong. So in my mind, why, you know, and if they're functional and they're happy and, you know, I don't see, these people are valuable for their different neurology as opposed to, you know, trying to quote unquote fix that aspect of them. So if people aren't, in my mind, doing something wrong, I don't see what the problem is.
I love this answer because you're showing some complexity here. You're empathizing with those who can't empathize with you.
Okay, there you go.
you're showing compassion for them. How would it make you feel to have this forced upon you? Yeah, it's exactly what you're doing.
Well,
but it's, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then the next step is we already have ways of creating empathy. You don't need a pill, although that would be, you know, that's always the magic bullet. Everyone's always looking for the pharmacological easy fix. And let's face it, we all know that for every quote-unquote magic bullet, there are a ton of side effects and other things that happen. But there are ways of creating empathy that we already know work. For instance, we already know working with autists that there are forms of behavioral conditioning that work to increase their empathy. So that's a psychological. So we know that we already know that works. We also know that, and this goes back to a conversation we all had, I think may have been the very first thing we all talked about, and that was the notion that storytelling actually creates empathy. Storytelling is an empathy engine, and it has been since we've been telling stories, because the act of telling a story is putting yourselves into the shoes of a character and imagining living that life through them.
Right.
And what we know is, the more stories we're exposed to, the more we actually read narratives, the more empathetic we can become. The people who don't read stories, you know, narratives, who don't get involved in storytelling, actually have less practice empathizing. The act of reading a novel is practice for empathy.
Hmm.
And interestingly, movies can do this to a certain extent, but not reading seems to be the really potent empathy pill, because you're using neural pathways that already exist in your mind. You know, if you're reading about a prince in a castle, you already have an image of a castle in your head, and you already know what a prince looks like. They're your prince and your castle. My prince and my castle are going to look very different than your prince and your castle. And because it's my personal prince and my personal castle, that has a much stronger effect on creating empathy than if I'm being handed, you know, Peter Jackson's prince and his castle.
Right, right.
So
you're creating that. I mean, it's marked for you. It's part of your whole makeup in some way.
Because you're actually riding the same neural pathways that already exist. You know, you're
right.
firing neurons that have already been tweaked for that purpose. And through the use of storytelling, you can create empathy for people, things, et cetera, that you could never have conceived of had you not read that story. You can learn to have empathy for different cultures. You can learn to have empathy for different creatures, beyond your species, but beyond everything. Even in movie making, you look at a movie like WALL-E, you're having empathy for a robot.
Right.
And not even a humanoid robot, a bicentennial man, you know? It's for a little cute, dumpy thing that looks like a walking ashtray.
Mm-hmm.
If you can put yourself in the shoes of that little dumpy ashtray, that's quite a feat.
AJ, there was a book that came out a couple of years ago by Jeffrey Masson, and it was called, and the title of the book is called The Dog Who Couldn't Stop Loving. And it's less about one particular dog, although he keeps referring back to that dog. It's more he spends a lot more time talking about the story of dogs and people and how they affected one another. The traditional historical view of dogs has always been, well, they're domesticated wolves. Wolf cub was brought in and they domesticated it. And he said Jeffrey Masson says the latest research from scientists says that there's some evidence that it was a case of co-domestication.
Yes.
That dogs changed people as much as people changed the wolf into the dog. That our ability to empathize cross species had a profound effect on us and our mirror neurons and everything else, so that we can empathize with each other better. And I find that a fascinating theory. And I wonder if you come across anything like that. If you read anything similar to that.
I know I haven't read that specific book, but I've certainly read that kind of thing mentioned, and this notion of cross domestication, and especially with dogs, they're really starting to believe that it's not just dogs being able to read people, but we increasingly are able to read dogs. I buy that. I absolutely buy that.
Mm-hmm. We know that dogs have been with us forever, beyond even the fossil record. You can go to the most remote tribe in New Guinea or in South America, and, the tribes that haven't had contact with people, with other outside people forever and ever, and there's dogs with them. The dog is everywhere. So it points to a very early, companionship between the two species. But then you go back and you – the fossil record, and you've got, even Neanderthals, I believe, had been buried with dogs with them. So, dogs have been with us forever and ever, and it had as much effect on us as it did on them. I find that idea fascinating. I don't know how much has been nailed down, but it just feels right. I guess that's the right way to put it.
Well, I'll tell you, I've been spending the week with some friends of mine who have a really remarkable dog. His name is Pluto, and he's what's referred to as a New Zealand Huntaway, which is a kind of sheep herding dog. And the sheep herding dogs are especially famous. You think of Border Collies as kind of the ultimate of this, are especially famous for their ability to read human reactions. But I've been spending a week with this dog, and he is as playing us as much as we are playing him. And I watch him work my kids and work his owners. He is so smart, but it's beyond just smart. It's like he understands our mental states, and he knows what to do to get the reaction that he wants, and vice versa. He has a face that is so expressive, to the point where I don't know if I've ever met a breed of dog that has such an expressive face. It's almost human facial expressions. Like, you can recognize them, Paul Ekman would be able to read this dog's face. and I have to believe that is an example of that, co-evolution that exists between dogs and humans.
Yeah.
That's really amazing. I mean, when you think about the idea that we brought each other along like that, and I go back to that original question about modeling. And here we have generation upon generation upon generation over time of us modeling them, trying to identify with them, getting better and better at feeling what they're feeling and them reciprocally doing the same for us, and the fact that we're doing it for each other, making it a more complete experience. It's really amazing to think how profound of a change that may have actually brought about in humanity. What was the name of that book again, Stephen? I never heard of that before.
The Dog Who Couldn't Stop Loving, and he uses his dog. His dog is the dog in the title there. It had been meant to be a dog for handicapped people. First, they tried to train it to be a seeing eye dog, and then at another point, they wanted to train it to be a helper dog for older people. But his problem was, this particular dog's problem was that he loved everybody equally. I mean, a complete stranger, it was as worthy of his undying affection as the person he was supposed to be taking care of. And this particular dog, they finally gave up and said, look, this dog is meant for one thing and one thing only. It's to love everybody. We cannot train him. He's just not well suited to be this sort of helper dog. He needs just a good family. And so they took him in, and they were a little bit, he didn't really want a big dog. You know, I'm traveling from continent to continent. And at any rate, he completely captured their hearts because he just a complete, fool for love, And very much like what you were describing, PJ. And I've got a dog in my, our family has this wonderful dog named Marty. And, I mean, every morning he'll come in and he vocalizes. I mean, he tries to talk. It's the funniest thing. He'll wake us up in the morning, and he wants to go out, and he has a certain way he says that. It's the funniest thing. He's Scooby-Doo, or as close to it as is possible in the real world. And we just love him, and he loves us, and yes, we read his expressions, and it's a funny thing. It makes me think, that maybe if we're going to model a friendly AI after somebody, maybe we should not model it after us. Maybe we ought to start by modeling the dog and then go from there. I don't know.
I love that idea.
I think that's great. Yep.
Who knows? A lot of work.
I think it's worth a shot. Absolutely. Well, let's go back to the idea of storytelling just for a minute. I had a thought on that, PJ, as you were talking about that. In the marketing world, lately, storytelling has become a big buzzword. I mean, it's always been around. We've heard this forever. That the company's going to tell their story or what have you. But particularly as I'm living these days at the nexus of marketing and HR, I'm hearing a lot more about storytelling techniques as an effective means of doing, of all things, business communications. And there are people who are truly specializing in effectively taking problems that need to be solved, even policies that have to be introduced, important ideas that have to be conveyed, and turning those into narratives, turning those into actual stories that people can kind of get their heads and their hearts around a little bit, and becoming much more effective communicators. Now, to me, it's very interesting that something that is seen as kind of the key to good communication is also the key to establishing empathy. And I guess my hypothetical here is looking to the future, is it possible that if we become more interested in storytelling as a means of communicating, will we find a world wherein our business world becomes more empathetic? Any chance of that, do you think?
I think, interestingly, that's exactly what's happening. There are basically two conflicting memes out there right now. One is that, corporations are psychopaths. We've all heard that. The notion that, they're only after achieving profit, that anything that stands in their way will be mowed down in front of them. It's all about shareholders, and it's not about any kind of socially conscious business practices. And the other meme out there, and you see this in smaller companies who have the flexibility, frankly, to do this, and that is the notion of social awareness and also empathy. I mean, even down to how they consider their customers. In a big established corporation where it's very hard to turn that giant ship, you usually see the customer looked upon as an inconvenience. In small companies, it's about, you know, imagining yourself in the customer's shoes. What do they want? What can we provide for them? How can we do it better? How can we be the people they turn to? And that's an empathetic act. The actual, you know, the whole entrepreneurial impulse
right.
is
right.
often an empathetic act. And I find it fascinating that, you know, you have these two conflicting means, you know, the corporation is psychopath and the corporation is empath. As, for me, in many ways, the end of one era and the beginning of another. That companies that realize it is about storytelling and aren't doing it cynically, because let's face it, there is a cynicism. If I hear one more, you know, VCs talk about this all the time. If they hear one more person say, what's the story? Here's my story. What's the story? We do learn things more effectively through narrative. It's
right.
how we're wired. Again, we're wired to put ourselves into the shoes of another. We're wired for stories. That's how we learn. But I think there's a lot of room for companies to actually really want to tell their story and really, more importantly, want to know the story of their customers. And that's where this reciprocity, this empathetic reciprocity comes in. Thinking of themselves not as separate from their customer base, but as integral, as part of the customer's tribe. Wanting
right.
to become a part of their customer's tribe and wanting the customer to become part of their tribe. So the only way you can do that is through this mutual empathy. I think it's a really interesting notion, and I hope it, the, you know, the cynical part of me who grew up in the business world hopes that it isn't used for evil, that it doesn't go to the dark side.
Well, there's always that possibility, although, you know, having been in the business world for, you know, mumble years, I would say that it's probably more appropriate to say that corporations are more like autistic people than that they are like out and out psychopaths, right? I mean, they're highly functioning without reference to empathy to others most of the time, and if they're like a person, they're more like kind of a geeky, somewhat self-absorbed person rather than. I haven't seen too many organizations that I would really compare to the Matt Damon character in The Talented Mr. Ripley, right?
I think that meme is for companies like, you know, Enron.
Yeah.
you know, the Exxon during the Exxon Valdez, you know, things like
right,
that.
Right.
You're talking
yeah.
about companies that really have done really horrible things and,
sure.
you know,
yeah,
and haven't cared.
Football and that sort of thing, sure, yeah.
But to be fair, I mean, using Enron as an example, you know, Jeff Skillings was a classic example of someone who was, in fact, a sociopath, had
right.
no empathy, not only had no empathy for the people he was doing business with, had no empathy for the people who worked with him and, you know, was famous for abusing them and everything else. So, you know, let's face it, there's also something to be said for it coming from the top down.
Right.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, I like the idea that there might be something genuine going on there. That always surprises me when I see it in the business world. And I've gotten to be on so many different sides of some of these kinds of things. I've seen storytelling introduced before in the I guess mid '80s, late '80s. We were doing business process improvement. And this is when I first learned about scenario-based planning, Peter Schwartz and the Global Business Network, and a lot of that whole approach to the future. And one of the things that was very compelling was this idea of, oh, we're going to help shape a better path to the future by writing down a story about it. And that idea, you know, it kind of caught on. It didn't absolutely change the way businesses plan necessarily, certainly the way they interact with the world or with each other, but just a qualitative difference in how you're looking at the world when you're telling a story about what's going to happen next versus when you put a Gantt chart together or something like that. I mean, it feels completely different, and it seemed like scenarios
made a real difference in terms of kind of humanizing the whole process. And so, to me, I'm very encouraged when I see businesses, the business world taking an interest in storytelling. I agree with you. I hope it does good and doesn't go to the dark side. That's a good way of looking at it.
Well, you know, it's interesting too, because I think you touched on an issue that is very complex because it's about complexity. And in telling a story can, in one way, illuminate complexity. You know, characters can be very complex, situations can be very complex, but in another way, sometimes storytelling simplifies to the point of misunderstanding. Mm. And there is this notion that, as important as empathy is, and I happen to think it is literally what makes the world go round, and I could get into, you know, Robert Wright and the idea of non-zero sum interactions, you know, and how that developed and how empathy came along with that, et cetera. But at a certain point, we're dealing with levels of complexity where it's very hard to grasp just through a story. And we're really only wired to get as complex as a story, meaning that our understanding to really grasp for the average person, they can only grasp the story.
Right.
Anything more complex, and we know the world is far more complex than that, is out of their realm of understanding. And that's when stories can be manipulative. You know, when people start telling stories that aren't really true, but they touch on our emotional centers, they touch on our fear, they touch on our concerns, and we buy into a story when in reality it is no reflection of reality. That the reality is far more complex than the story could ever describe, and we're making decisions on very large issues that affect the future through simple stories which cannot describe, they cannot model the real situation. And that is my personal concern.
Well, that's one advantage to the Peter Schwartz scenario-based planning, which is that there would always be at least three scenarios, right? So you would always tell at least three stories,
right.
And even if each one of those is really simple-minded and might take you in the wrong direction, you get this multi-dimensionality to it. But I see what you're saying. If you don't have all three, I think you need at least three. Maybe that should be the rule for the world. That's a good story. Let me hear two more, right? Maybe I can make a reasonable judgment about what to do next. So where does that put us then? If stories are our best hope for being empathetic, but we have to be careful about stories, does that mean we need better stories? We need stories and something else?
I think we need to know the limit of stories. What I think stories are great for is taking someone who would be considered the other, whom we might distrust, whom we might fear, because they're different than we are, and giving us a basis for commonality where we no longer fear them, they are no longer the other, they're one of us. And that's where empathy's real power lies. If you're using the empathy of storytelling to model very complex situations, I think that's not going to work. But when you're taking, you know, for instance, when we're looking in the future, we talk a lot about, you know, what happens when we have people, the haves and have-nots of transhuman technologies, et cetera. You know, we already have this now. We already have people who are getting superior health care, who are living longer, who are living very different lives than other people in the world who don't have those things. And it's very easy to demonize one side or the other as either, well, you know, they couldn't get their act together, so really they don't deserve it. Or, you know, they have everything given to them on a silver platter. They're
right.
Taking stuff away from me. How you know, that's horrible. Instead of this demonization on either side, stories can bridge that gap. You know, one of the things
my
that
favorite
I'm fascinated
I was just going to say, my favorite story along those lines is probably Enemy Mine.
Yes.
That movie is just an awesome example of, you know, the other meeting each other and forced together and eventually accepting each other. It's a beautiful story, and you know, maybe we need more stories like that.
Well, I think we do, because you know what we're going to, as just the fact that we now have the ability to communicate with people all around the world means that our once tribal brains are forced to empathize outside of our family, outside of our tribe, and forced to empathize with people of very different backgrounds, very different cultures, religions, values, morality, etc. And the only way we're going to be able to communicate is to find those bases of commonality and imagine ourselves in each other's shoes. And that's where geek culture comes in. Because in geek culture, we've been spending, you could say, 1,000 years, but really the last 100 years very intensely, taking the other and making it the center of our stories and, you know, later on the protagonist of our stories, where you were forced to relate to a character who was so unlike anything you could possibly experience on Earth. They were either superhuman, you know, it was either Superman or Frankenstein's creature or Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde or Pinocchio or, you know, now we're talking more modernly, and an Enemy Mine, the kids in X-Men, et cetera, where...
Yeah.
You're now in the shoes of someone who isn't fully human. And you're siding with them.
Right.
Because you can understand what it's like to be them. And it's that act, this acceleration of empathy for characters that are not human, that I think is the best hope we have in the future of a socialization of people of different abilities, et cetera.
So a better future through science fiction, basically.
I absolutely believe it. Science fiction, you know, science fiction has done lots of things for humanity. You know, it's given us cell phones and lasers and satellites and all kinds of nifty things. But I think the most important thing it's done is actually open our eyes to the fact that we can empathize not just with fellow humans, but with things that aren't human.
Right.
We can empathize with Wally, you know, our little trash compactor of a robot, and imagine ourselves in that character's shoes. So if I can imagine myself as a robot, when I meet a robot, I will be far more disposed to be open to it than to fear it.
And if we can...
No, I got to tell you about the reaction of my little son to the climactic scene where Wally is keeping the thing from closing, whatever that was that was crushing him.
Right.
You know, my little four-year-old son, I mean, screams out in the theater, "No!" and then hides his face. And he just absolutely absorbed into that little character. And, I mean, it was... I don't know. As a parent, you just I don't know if what the right words are, but I mean, you just the innocence of that, plus the fact that he was, you know, he had taken that character to heart, and it was a beautiful thing. So yeah,
he's taken that character to heart.
Real quick, I'm sorry. Stephen, did you set us up to extend past the hour?
I did not. But go ahead.
All right.
Go ahead.
So, PJ, this will be the last word, whatever you have to say.
The ability for your son to connect with Wally is so fundamental in how we have to move forward. The idea that we could put ourselves in the point of view that little boy could understand what that robot was feeling is how we're going to be able to continue in a positive future.
There you have it.
Right.
If we can,
great last
one. If we can sympathize with Wally, if we can empathize with Wally, maybe there's a chance we can empathize with each other, particularly as we've become more Wally-like as years go by. Well, the time went by way too fast, as I feared it. My PJ, always a pleasure having you on. Happy PJ Manny Week to you. And,
thanks, guys.
And to all our listeners. And, Stephen, what's our music?
The song is Bigger Than Us by Fundus Inc.
Great choice, Bigger Than Us. Thanks for putting that together. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll be back again on Saturday night. And please join us for all of our upcoming programs. Until next time, live to see it.
Inspiration. If you believe.